Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 1st of July 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 42 in our Patriotic look back through history here, where we are currently concentrating on British history, and I am of course joined today by my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day sir, how are you doing?
Hi Sven. Yeah, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Very good, very good. I'm looking forward to getting into our podcast tonight. We might even get as far as Boadicea. We're going to be talking a little bit about Caractacus, the famous British king, and we might also talk a little bit more about the birth of Christianity and how it is all intertwined together. And we'll be using our notebook where we're taking our quotes from, as once again it will be taken from R.W. Morgan's The British Cymry, and I really can't recommend that book enough for learning about British history. It's a bit rough around the edges, but it's a very, very patriotic look at history, and it's a lot of history that's covered up, and most of it I have found to be extremely accurate. And he uses quotes, but he's getting his information from people like Julius Caesar, Strabo, Tacitus, all these famous Roman authors. And if you actually look up the characters that he's talking about, you can see that Wikipedia has pages on them, but it tells them from the Roman, it tells the story from the Roman point of view, whereas R.W. Right. Morgan is telling the story from the British point of view. So he's looking at what the Romans had to say, and he's saying, oh, well, this has got to be propaganda here. This is them glossing this little bit here because they got beaten by the British, whereas it's not going to tell you that in the Wikipedia pages. But they do have a Wikipedia page on Mandubratius, who is Arvarui, the traitor that we've talked about. They've got a Wikipedia page on Caradoc, Caractacus, who we'll be talking about tonight, Pomponia Gracchina, and it even mentions the story about the first British church in Rome on Wikipedia. And these are all things that R.W. Morgan talks about that most people are just completely unaware of. They don't realise that that is a part of our history. So I do think he's a very good author. He was known for being a very good author at the time and a big champion of Welsh history. And he was also a prelate in the Church of Wales, which was the equivalent of the Anglican Church. So things have really changed in the church since his day,
and
basically.
How old was he alive? I mean, what a decade was he born?
I think it was about 1850, 1860 when he was writing.
Right.
So probably the 1820s, 1810, 1820 when he was born.
Okay. And so I guess this was before then a lot of the architectural finds in the sort of 19th to early 20th century kind of came to fruition, right?
Yes. This was before they found, I think this is before they found the library at Nineveh. I think they had found the remains at Hisarlik of Troy. This is sort of probably right about that time, maybe before they found Tutankhamun's tomb. And definitely before they translated the Behistun Rock, when Rawlinson translated the Behistun Rock. I think it was before all of that. So his idea is basically that the British people came from Gomer, from Japhet. He understands the Gomer connection to Cymru, but he didn't work out that that was based on the Hebrew king Comri. The name spelled, pronounced with that guttural G in Assyrian is Gomri.
Right.
Which then became Cymry, which then became Cimmerian. So he was looking at it and thinking, well, it's close to Gomer, so it must originate from this Gomer, who was the son of Japhet. So he gets that wrong, but everything else I think he gets right. And he also uses the Welsh triads to back up what he's saying. And of course, he's cross-referencing them with what it says in the Roman histories. So everything is being double checked, and it is. I think he's a great historian, and very, very patriotic as well. I think if you look at history books pre 1930s, they all come across as extremely patriotic compared to history books today, which are trying not to be subjective in any way whatsoever. They're trying to be as inclusive as possible. But you're talking about history. Yeah. It's his story. It's one nation's story. So you can't include everybody else or please everybody else with it. You know, you have manifold views of history. And I like a patriotic view of it. That's what it's for.
Well, I guess his story from the modern globalist perspective is the story of a small clique of people, I guess, and not necessarily the story of the native people of that nation.
Well, I think they try to do a whole story of mankind or humanity as if it was all just one group together, and it's never been that. It's always been various groups competing against one another. And obviously their view of history, although there might be similar events that get talked about, there's going to be a different view on what happened at those events as well. But anyway, let's get into what R.W. Morgan has to say about Caractacus and what we got up to last week. The Romans had invaded once again, and this was under Caligula this time, and he'd sent his general Aulus Plotius to lead the charge. The line of advance taken by Plotius was the same as that upon which Julius Caesar had, after the action at Carcolis, moved towards the metropolis, the Guadalian Road. The British army under Guiderius and his cousin Caradoc, or Caractacus, was drawn up on the flat between the Kentish hills and the Thames on the spot where now stands the town of Deptford. The battle which ensued terminated in the retreat of Guiderius along the south bank of the river, where near Richmond a second battle was fought, in which the British sovereign was slain. He was succeeded by Arviragus, but the national emergency requiring that unity of action could only be secured by unity of command, Caradoc was by the unanimous voice of the National Council nominated to the Pendragonate, Arviragus himself giving the first vote in his favour and consenting to act under him. So we have two kings there. Caradoc is this famous king. There are places that are named after him. We'll find out why he was famous. And there's also this Arviragus that gets mentioned quite a lot. And there isn't, we don't have records of anybody named Arviragus, but the Romans do talk about him. And I've got a quote here from Wilson and Blackett, which actually talks about Arviragus. And they say, and this is, they're basically talking about something else, but they then start talking about him. They say, it has to be remembered that British history was preserved in southeast Wales, and that the arrival of Joseph of Arimathea, known as St. Ilyd, in AD 37 is well traceable. This leads to the sites where he set up places of worship, and most importantly, to the foundation on lands given to him by the British king named as King Gwyrth, who ruled the Midlands of present-day England. This powerful British king was known to the Romans as Arviragus, which might mean after the Virago, or after Boudicca. And Roman poets mocked Nero in his fear of this Arviragus, King Gwyrth. One wrote how Caesar might be fortunate if Arviragus slipped from his chariot pole and broke his neck. It does not take a genius to recognise Gwyrth as George, and it was to this George Gwyrth that St. Ilyd, or Joseph of Arimathea, gave the white flag with the red cross upon it that is still the flag of England today. So they think the actual George's Cross, St. George's Cross, originated with this George. But we don't really want to get into the story of St. George today, but they're basically saying this, that the name Arviragus, it means after the Virago, and we can actually trace the king that this was, and it was a King Gwyrth, according to the Welsh genealogies.
Arviragus. I mean, it doesn't sound too British by today's standards, does it?
No,
what was the other name? Caractacus, mentioned earlier.
Caradoc. Craddock. Like Fanny Craddock?
Caradoc.
Yeah, Caradoc. Okay. So that is still sort of in use today. But what the Romans did, they sort of added US at the end of things, didn't they? They like to add as a suffix, I think that is, not a prefix. So they added things to names. Well, Caradoc withdrew his forces across the Thames at Chertsey with Plotius in pursuit, attempting to force the passage, but was thrice repulsed with loss. The fourth attempt was successful. The Roman army, being divided into three battalions under Plotius, Flavius Vespasian, the future emperor, and his brother, entered the river at so many different points, while a strong body of German cavalry, which had swum across lower down, took the British position in flank. And we remember in the first invasion, they used the Gauls, and now by this time, 50, 60 years later, they've got Germanic cavalry as well. And we got Vespasian here, who we also know of from his conquering of Judea, Vespasian and Titus. So we've got some pretty serious warriors here fighting against us in Britain. The engagement on the north side after the passage had been effected lasted, according to Dion Cassius, the Greek historian, who drew his materials from the imperial or state records at Rome, for two whole days, the Pendragon being at last defeated by a most daring manoeuvre made on his flank and rear by Cneius Geta, the recent conqueror of Mauritania. So highly was this exploit appreciated that Geta was rewarded with a triumph, an almost unprecedented honour under the circumstances, for he had not yet attained the consular dignity. So again, that shows us what great fighters we were, because this Cneius Geta managed to defeat our king in this battle that lasted for 2 days. He was given a triumph. If he had just beaten somebody that didn't really have a lot of renown and wasn't known for being a great warrior, then he wouldn't have been given a triumph, would he? So, you know, it tells you how good we were and you know, how much we were looked up to, basically, I think.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And also the Pendragon. I mean, we'll just say once again, that means head dragon. And the Pendragon was the military dictator that was given power over the whole country in times of war, basically. And that's why Caradoc has been voted to be the Pendragon. Caradoc, instead of retiring into the interior, led his forces around London into the Essex Fens. Plotus and Vespasian, in following him, were so roughly handled that messengers were dispatched to Rome for reinforcements and instructions. The emperor himself immediately left Rome, and passing through Gaul, landed at Richborough with the 2nd and the 14th legions, their auxiliaries, and a cohort of elephants, where he effected a junction with Plotius at Verulam. The army, thus strengthened, moved against Carcol or Colchester, with the Coritani under Adminius joining its ranks and raising the standard of rebellion in the rear of the Pendragon. So we've got this traitor nation has joined up with the Romans once again. Dion Cassius calls Carcol the Basileon, or the royal city of Cymbeline, the father of Arviragus. In its defence, Caradoc was persuaded against his own judgment to hazard another pitched field. His defeat was decisive. A cohort of elephants brought over by Claudius with this especial view, rendering negatory all the efforts of the charioteers to urge their steeds as heretofore onto the Roman lines. And after a brief resistance, Colchester surrendered. So here we have where we get this bit where this king Gwyrith actually came from, because we're being told here Dion Cassius confirmed that Carcol was the royal city of Cymbeline, the father of Arviragus, and we know that the son of this Cymbeline was this Gwyrith chap that Blackett and Wilson were talking about. So that's how we can identify him from looking at the Welsh family trees and also looking at what the Romans and the Greeks have to say about this. I don't know if you've got any comments on any of that.
No, not quite. I mean, can we elaborate more on the traitor nation? Do we know more about, like, why they were traitorous?
Well, this was the excuse that was used for coming in by Claudius. That was the excuse, because this nation, the Coritani, and I think the Iceni as well, had appealed to Rome to be part of their protectorate. And Rome then used that as the excuse to come in. And before that, when we heard about Arvirui, and I think it was his tribe with the Coritani or the Corinidae, and he basically made a treaty with Rome. And when Julius Caesar came in to fight against Cymbeline, he fought on the side of the Romans and opened up the gates of London. So Arvirui ended up having to flee, but his tribe was still here. And his tribe was obviously not very well treated by the rest of the people in Britain. So they then went and appealed to Claudius, saying, please come and help us. Help us get our lands back. We're being mistreated by the rest of the people in Britain because we joined up with you against the rest of the British tribes, basically. So now you've got the same thing again. And Claudius has said, right, well, I'm going to come in and I'm going to get these lands back, using that as an excuse, basically, because Rome used to use that as the excuse to go into various countries. It's a similar thing to saying, well, we need to go in there because he's gassing his own people. They're sort of saying, we need to go in there because they're being mistreated by the Pendragon. So it's, they use the same excuses today. When a bigger country goes in, claiming to be going in to help out the smaller country, it's usually because the bigger country wants to take the smaller country over. But they don't want it to look like that. So that's what this Coronidae are up to. And we will hear more about them as well. Claudius, satisfied with their success, concluded a treaty with the two states of the Coronidae and the Iceni, by which it was stipulated that on the payment of a certain amount of tribute, they should, under the Roman protectorate, be guaranteed the retention of their lands, their laws, and their native government. So this treaty was with Caradoc, not to keep taking the lands of the Coronidae, basically. The treaty wasn't with the two states, the Coronidae, so much as it was with Caradoc not to keep going in there against them. And this was the excuse that they used. So the Romans at this point have sort of pacified two tribes. They've got two tribes on their side. Claudius, then taking his departure and leaving the further prosecution of the war to Plotius, Vespasian and Geta, celebrated his triumph at Rome with signal magnificence. The more impressive from the humility displayed by himself in ascending the steps of the Capitol on his knees, supported on either side by his sons-in-law. To Rubrius Pollio, his prefect, the Senate decreed a statue, and to Plotius, a public triumph. So they saw this as a huge victory. A huge victory. They've got these two tribes on their side, and the rest of the Britons have agreed that they're not going to keep attacking them. Undismayed by his reverses, or by the presence of the three ablest generals of Rome in the field against him, Caradoc, having wasted the territories of the Coronaid with fire and sword, transferred the scene of warfare from the Champagne countries to the hilly districts of the southwest. Vespasian was dispatched with the Roman fleet to effect a landing at Torbay, whilst Plotius marched upon the Pendragon by land, Geta being left in command at Colchester with orders to commence the construction of a line of fortresses from the head of the Fens, now forming the Isle of Ely, to Gloucester. This immense work, the object of which was to enclose Caradoc between the forces of Vespasian and the rising circumvallation in his rear, and compel him either to a precipitate abandonment of the southern portion of the island or to a surrender, was carried on with the usual indefatigable energy of the Roman legionaries. So the rest of the country is still fighting. It's not that much of a victory. They've just got, the Romans have just pacified the south, basically.
Right, and basically a lot of people still kind of unsettled and not willing to accept, you know, kind of the new authorities.
Yeah, the rest of the country is supporting Caradoc. Tower after tower arose, each as it was completed being occupied by its appropriate garrison. Vespasian, meanwhile attended by his son Titus, subsequently the conqueror of Judea and Jerusalem, and his successor in the empire, after being repulsed by Arviragus in an attack made by them on Dover Castle, a position of great strength, directed their course to Torbay, where they landed in the fourth year of the war, June the 3rd, AD 47. Devonshire, Dorsetshire, and the south of Somersetshire were then included under the general name of Devineth, which is Damnonia and Devonia, or the Deep Vales. So you see, the war's been going on for 4 years now, and this is the the quality of the generals that are fighting against our king. They were the conquerors of Judea and Jerusalem, Vespasian and Titus.
Mm-hmm.
The campaigns which followed would require a volume to do them justice. They absorbed, during the time they were carried on, the undivided attention of the Roman world. Since the days of Mithridates, no opponent of the pretensions of Rome to universal dominion had appeared worthy to be compared in martial qualities and steadiness of purpose with the British Pendragon. The camps, Roman and British, pitched at almost regular intervals in hostile frontage of each other over the whole surface of Devonia, remain insuppressible evidences of the desperate nature of the conflict which raged for 3 years within its confines. According to Suetonius, 30, according to Eutropius, 32 battles were fought between Vespasian and Caradoc in this brief period. Their mere number proves that in none of them could either side boast of any very decisive advantage. So what he's saying there is that the evidence is still there that this went on. You've got the remains of these camps. If you go to Devon and Dorset, you can see the remains of the Roman camps and the British camps where these battles took place. And there are places that were named after these battles as well. And the fact we kept fighting them for 3 years.
Wow.
I think it went on. Wow. I think the resistance went on for 38 years in all.
Really?
Yeah.
That's, that must have been pretty deep-rooted, isn't it? To change it, it must take that long to change a generation and pacify and then, and almost indoctrinate the next generation into the ways of Rome.
Well, they write about the Druids and it being a really patriotic religion. And the Britons were great patriots, and I think we can interpret from that they took sovereignty very seriously, and did not
be
want
interesting
to.
Sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say they did not want to be subjects to anybody else, basically.
No, with regards to the faith of the nation, Britain was Christian by this point, right?
No, it wasn't Christian, but there were Christians there.
Right.
Joseph of Arimathea had arrived with his missionaries, with some of the disciples, and they'd been given 12 hides of land at Glastonbury. Wilson and Blackett say that it was somebody somewhere else in the country with a similar name that was in the Midlands. But according to the Saxons, it was Glastonbury in the southwest of the country. So they had 12 hides of land somewhere, and they had started their mission. And they had converted some Druids, obviously, but the nation itself had not decided to become Christian yet. That wouldn't happen for about another 100 years. But we will hear more about the gradual expansion of Christianity in Britain. When we were talking about the two saints, St. Beatus, and I think
I'm assuming that the Christianity, especially Roman Catholicism, probably became more widespread. Kind of in like a correlation with Rome's expansion as well, right?
Well, Catholicism or Roman Catholicism didn't start until Rome legalized Christianity. At the moment, Christianity is illegal within the Roman Empire. And
right, okay.
It wasn't until about 300 and something AD that Rome legalized Christianity, and that was about 200 years after Britain had become the first nation to pronounce itself Christian. And the reason why it did that is because the Emperor Constantine was a British king. So he'd been brought up to be a Christian. And that's why he legalized Christianity once he got to Rome. It wasn't because he had a vision and a dream and
really
saw a cross. It was because he was brought up a Christian. Yeah, we'll get into all the details of that.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've heard that. But everyone knows, though, he saw a comet coming down, and it was a sign from the heavens.
That's the legend, but the facts are and the histories are that he was a British king, and his mother was Princess Helen, who was the daughter of Old King Cole, which is from the nursery rhyme Old King Cole, and his father was, I think, Maxentius, the Roman emperor, who had a palace in North Wales, and it tells you that he married this Welsh princess, and the son was was Constantine. I mean, the marriage itself may not have taken place in Britain, and that may have given rise to the princess not being from Britain. But he was the Roman emperor, and he brought over soil from Rome to actually put in his palace, so that he could still be ruling from Roman soil even when he was in his palace in North Wales. And there was three emperors at the time. I can't remember exactly each one of their names, but there were three of them at the time. And when they died, Constantine, because he was the king of Britain and he was also the son of the emperor of Rome in the triumvirate, he marched on Rome with his army, took it over, and then built Constantinople. And then you had like the East Roman Empire and the West Roman Empire. And that's why you have the double eagle on the symbol of Orthodox Christianity and on the symbol for Russia. It's the eagle facing the east and the west, the eagle of the Roman Empire. And that came about after Constantine. But that wasn't until about 350 BC. And at this time, these royal families, these royals that we were talking about, they were the ancestors by a couple of hundred years of Constantine. And right. we'll hear about when Caradoc becomes a Christian anyway, because he's not yet a Christian. But we'll okay. hear all about that as we get into this. The headquarters of Vespasian and Titus were fixed at the great camp at Hampton Hill near Ilchester, the area of which is able to accommodate 100,000 men. On ground now forming a farm called Conquest Farm, Bishop's Lydiard, near a smaller camp of 20 acres, Arviragus, in the absence of Caradoc, sustained a total defeat. Vespasian, after his victory, proceeded to invest Carrasque, or Exeter. On the eighth day of the siege, he was surprised in his entrenchments by Caradoc and Arviragus and routed with a great slaughter. Titus had on this occasion the glory of saving his father's life. The British attack was so sudden and overwhelming that Vespasian was on the point of being slain in his tent, when Titus, at the head of the first cohort of the 14th Legion, divining his father's danger, charged his captors and, after a sanguinary conflict, rescued him from their hands. So all around Dorset and all around Exeter, you're going to find remains of the Romans being there and the Britons being there and these battles that they had. And this is recorded in the Roman histories about Titus saving Vespasian's life here. The fluctuations in the fortunes of the war, which ensued until the recall of Aulus Plautius and the appointment of Ostorius Scapula to the chief military command of the armies of invasion, are tersely but graphically summed up by Tacitus, the Roman oligarchic historian, in his description of the career of Caradoc, saying, "The Silures reposed unbounded confidence in Caractacus, enumerating the many drawn battles he had fought with the Romans, the many victories he had obtained over them." Close quote. The disingenuousness of the Roman historians is in nothing more conspicuous than in the determined silence that they observe as to the names, localities, and details of these British victories. Every British reverse being, on the other hand, carefully and circumstantially chronicled. So one other thing we've got to think of here is these Roman generals were being rotated. So they would fight their battles, they would be here for a couple of years, and then they would be taken back to Rome and another general would be put in his place, whereas right. Caradoc and Arviragus didn't have anyone to replace them. So they were just being worn down.
Yeah, it's worn down, but they would have made also probably got a bit more familiar as well with the British soil, right?
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, as we'll see here, there were rules of lawfare as well. They end up having a truce in a bit, which is very interesting. The memory of the incorruptible and high-souled patriot who led the Britons in so many fields against a succession of the most skillful generals Rome could command was long cherished with ardent affection by the Cymry. Three have been, declare their triads, our hero kings: Cynvelin, Caradoc son of Bran, and Arthur. These so conquered their enemies that except by treachery they could not be overthrown. And another one, three have been the chief battle kings of the Isle of Britain, Caswallon, son of Beli, Arviragus, son of Cunvalin, and Caradoc, son of Bran. The popularity of Caradoc, alluded to by Tacitus, is testified to in another of their ancient records, which mentions him as one of the three kings whom every Briton from the sovereign to the peasant followed in their country's need to battle. So he was very highly thought of and remembered by the Welsh.
Well, that's what I was point I was trying to make, is that he would have really got to know the people as well, right?
Oh, the people from the whole country, yeah, because, I mean, originally he was from one certain part of Britain, and here we'll see, I mean, he's all over the south and into the southwest and up to the north of Wales. I think the Silures, I think they were a southwestern tribe, southwest Wales tribe originally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we see him going about the whole country here. I mean, you don't really hear about Scotland. Not sure what the tribes up there were doing, or whether there were many.
I'm not sure. I know the what in terms of the time frame, there were the Picts that were kind of the first to really populate Scotland, wasn't there? And then we had the Scythian, the Scythians that moved in via Spain, and they kind of came up that route, sort of migrating. If you listen to the Declaration of Arbroath, they kind of outline where they see themselves as, you know, coming from. So
I think there was more of a movement into Scotland sort of later on, wasn't there? From like 800 onwards. I don't think it was that populated at this time. Although I think it was more populated maybe 1,500 years before, when it was warmer. You know, remember when we looked at Skara Brae, the dwellings that are up there, the stone houses that are up there, and the monuments that are up there. I mean, it was obviously populated at that time, but the temperature was a lot warmer. I think it was a bit colder at this period. Nor are the literary claims of the, quote, patriotic harasser of Rome to be passed by without notice. Like most of the distinguished characters in Cymric Annals, he resembled David of Israel in uniting the prowess of the soldier with the inspiration of the bard. The spirit of personal adventure formed also a striking trait in his character. During the truce, which ensued on the recall of Plotius, he proceeded with him in order to grace the approaching marriage of his cousin Pomponia with his presence to Rome. Here, presenting himself before the Senate, he addressed them to the effect that, understanding it had been given out by the Roman generals that the forest defiles of Devon and Silurea were the chief cause of the non-success of their arms, he had given orders to burn down every tree from the sea to the Severn on his own patrimony in the latter country. Quote, not a sprig was left for the foot of a bird to rest upon, close quote. The houses, which were generally built, as in many parts of the principality they still are, of timber frames filled up with stones or bricks, being reconstructed of stone alone. So here we have, I don't know whether this is a legend or what, but we have a quote here that's saying that if the Romans were saying, well, it's because of all the forest land, that's why we keep losing, he said, well, we'll burn down the forest land and we'll still beat you. Being shown by his new connections the capital and other magnificent public and private edifices, he observed with the usual contempt of great minds for externals, it is singular a people possessing such splendid piles of marble at home should envy me a soldier's tent in Britain. Close quote. On the expiration of the truce and the return of Caradoc to his command, Ostorius Scapula, with the Plotian line of fortresses for his base of operations, proceeded to carry the war to the west of the Severn. Our summary will not enable us to do more than state that at the end of the third campaign, AD 52, Caradoc was defeated and his forces dispersed at Car Caradoc on the Venedotian frontiers, his wife and daughter Gladys or Claudia, with his two brothers, falling into the hands of the conqueror. And Car Craddock is in North Wales, a place that's named after him. And you, and again, up there, there's all the remains of these battles and places that are
really
that are named after him. So you can see here that, that they had rules of war, and when they had a truce, they stopped fighting, and he went to Rome. Because it, you'll remember in the last couple of episodes, we've talked about some of these princes being in Rome and being educated at Rome. It wasn't like the British were excluded from taking part in anything on the continent. They just retained their sovereignty, and they were still trading right. with Rome, and they were still taking part in the education that they could get at Rome. And you, you would go to Rome, and you would have all the up-to-date things that they had in the Roman civilization, much like today. You know, if you go, go onto the continent and go to the capital cities somewhere, there's all sorts of things that you can see. So I can imagine that the aristocracy and the rich youth, a lot of them probably went over to Rome, but in the middle of a battle here. And again, that's like in the middle of Russia and their military adventures in Ukraine, they've just had the St. Petersburg Economic Forum with people from all over the world going to St. Petersburg to make deals and all the rest of it in the middle of the war.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think ultimately they the civilization knows that its war is just a necessary part of the politics in shaping their culture and creating their own history, if, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, trying to be, you know, shut down the flow of life, it just not good for anybody, is it?
Well, you end up hurting yourself more than the people that you're trying to sanction, I think, is the lesson we're learning at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Caradoc himself took refuge at her repeated solicitations, that's at his daughter's solicitations, with Cartus Mandua, the queen of the Brigantes. And he was arrested when asleep in his chamber by a body of armed men loaded with chains and delivered up to the Romans. This infamous proceeding on the part of the granddaughter of the arch-traitor, Arvarui, inheriting his detestable spirit of falsehood and treachery, is known in the Triads as the first of the three secret betrayals of the Isle of Britain. So that's the granddaughter of this arch-traitor, Mandu Baratius. The granddaughter somehow was the queen of the Brigantes, Cartus Mandua, and the suspicion is that she drugged him. That's why he was asleep, right. And that's why he was able to be arrested. She turned traitor anyway, because he had sought sanctuary there, and she put him under chains, and the Romans arrested him.
I think with the influx of Roman officials, you know, there'd probably be a lot of people become treacherous, you know, with a bit of coin, kind of flirted their way.
Bribery and corruption, yeah. Yeah, people would give into that, and also the might of Rome, and think that they're going to get protection from Rome. Like if you were a petty king, and you wanted more than you actually had, or you thought that you were owed more than you actually had, and you had a petty kingdom, then you could go to Rome and say, "Well, I'll fight on your side if you make me the ruler of the island." Or if you give me more of a kingdom to rule. And that was the sort of thing that was going on here. I think the first instance with this, it was a falling out over who should rule London, or who was actually given a certain area to rule, and they thought that they should have been made king, and that's why they went to Rome to try and get their help. So that would come into it as well. Like arguments of who was going to rule, because he had all these separate little kingdoms in Britain at the time. Who are you going to go to arbitrate? And some people are going to go to Rome instead of going to the chief king in Britain. And also, Brutus established that the King of England was also the King of Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. Under those names at that time. And that's what Edward Longshanks, he was reinvigorating that law of Britain that was actually called one of the usages of Britain. It was the right of the King of England. And he was exercising that right by saying who could be the king in Scotland and who could be the king in Wales. And then the king of Wales rebelled against him, and the king of Scotland rebelled against him, or the princes in Scotland rebelled against him. And that's when he said, right, well, that's it. I'm just going to take the monarchy of Wales. That'll be mine from now on. And we're going to take the monarchy of Scotland if you're going to stab me in the back like that.
What was it that made him think that he was the highest king? We mentioned it in a previous podcast. I forgot.
Because he was the king of England. The king of England has the right to rule the other countries, and that was a right that was established by Brutus.
Right. Okay.
Way back when Brutus was the first monarch of Britain. And his right to rule came from the fact that he came from the royal family from Troy. It was the same right to rule that Julius Caesar had, because he was from the royal family at Troy. Troy was a very important city, very important civilization, the one that sort of preceded the Greek and the Roman one. Mm-hmm. It was the central one. Sent to Rome under a strong guard, the arrival of the illustrious captive excited the attention of all classes. The populace thronged the roads leading to the city to obtain a view of the man whose name, as the redoubted antagonist and oftentimes victor of Rome in the great Isle of the West, had for 9 years been familiar to their ears. The Senate was convened. Addresses comparing the event to the most glorious incidents, such as the fall of Hannibal, Mithridates, and Jugurtha in the times of the Republic, were delivered, and triumphal honours were decreed to Ostorius. The trial and speech of Caradoc before the throne of the emperor in the presence of the Senate are subjects too trite to be dilated upon. As free in chains as on his native hills, his calm and dignified demeanour commanded the admiration of the assembly. Had my policy, he said, in prosperous times been framed solely with a view to the preservation of my hereditary domains or the aggrandisement of my own family, I might long since have entered this city a friend, rather than a prisoner of war. Nor would you have disdained, as an ally, a king descended from illustrious ancestors and the Pendragon of many nations. My present condition, stripped of its former majesty as it is to me, is proportionately a triumph to you. I was lord of men, horses, arms, wealth. What wonder if I refused at your dictation to resign them? You aspire to universal dominion. Does it follow that every nation should accept the vassalage you would impose? I am now in your power, betrayed but not conquered. Had I, like others, yielded without resistance, where would have been the name of Caradoc, and where your glory? Oblivion would have buried both in the same tomb. Bid me live. I shall survive forever in history as one example, at least, of Roman clemency. So I think he's having a dig here at these other petty princes, because he was saying if he had wanted to aggrandize his own family or get more domains for himself, he might have entered in there as a friend and as a subject, like the Coritani did and like the Iceni did, that they're traitors to the rest of Britain. But he refused to do that, and he fought against them. And they didn't conquer him. He was betrayed. So he was asking for mercy, saying, why not go down in history as Rome the Merciful rather than just, Rome the Magnificent or Rome the Unconquered? Go down as Rome the Merciful as well.
Yeah. Why not add that to your string of achievements, eh?
Yeah. And he succeeded. The custom at those most revolting exhibitions of Roman pride and bloodthirstiness, called triumphs, was that at a certain spot on the Sacra Via, the captive kings and generals who followed barefooted, bareheaded, and in fetters, the triumphal car of their conqueror, should be removed from the procession, cast into the Tarpeian dungeons, and there strangled, decapitated, or left to perish of hunger. The mass of common prisoners were then condemned to slay each other in single combats at the next gladiatorial games for the amusement of the most degraded rabble that perhaps were ever collected within the walls of a great city. the preservation of Caradoc forms a solitary exception in the long catalogue of victims to this cowardly and atrocious policy. He was permitted to reside for 7 years in free custody at Rome. His aged father, Bran, and the whole of the royal family of Silurea being detained as hostages for him. I'll just stop there because it gives us a nice description of what went on and how their prisoners were treated. I mean, it's very barbaric.
Yeah.
And yet we're told, you know, the Britons were the barbarians, the Romans were the civilized ones. And yet the Britons obviously didn't want to take part in this. They didn't want to worship Caesar. They didn't want to worship the Roman gods. And I mean, this is barbaric what went on here.
Well, we know from in the New Testament the kind of punishment rituals they had, fleecing and what was it that they did to Christ? They flogged him, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know,
horrific.
And that was a common practice to flog people, and they had the tool that they used there. It was almost like a whip. If you imagine a whip with lots of different strands and kind of sharp teeth attached to the strands interwoven, and they would just kind of lash the back, and then as they caught, they just take out chunks of skin and flesh. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah, incredibly sadistic. So at least there was one prisoner of theirs that they didn't do all that to. So he's allowed to stay in Rome for 7 years, but he has to give his family up as hostages as well. And he was able to get his taxes there. You know, the Silures were still paying him taxes. And the fact that he had a dwelling at Rome, I mean, this tells you that he did go there during that truce, because he already had a residence there, the Palatium Britannicum. His residence was in the palace on the declivity of the Mons Sacer, converted by his granddaughter Pudentiana into the first Christian church at Rome, known first as the Titulus and now as Saint Pudentiana. And it also went by the name of the Hospitium Apostolorum and the Palatium Britannicum. It was basically the British palace at Rome where Caradoc was, and that got turned into the first Christian church at Rome. So it wasn't the Church of Rome, it was the British church that was at Rome. The Roman church wasn't established, as I say, until about 350 AD under Constantine. Mm-hmm. So the first actual church there was in the British palace. And you can look that up on Wikipedia, St. Pudentiana. It will tell you about it. Here, his daughter Gladys, or Claudia, was married to Rufus Pudens, a Roman patrician who had filled high civil and military positions in Britain and whose estates lay in the Umbrian Apennines. And again, I'll just stop there because they found evidence of this as well. They found a stone, I think it was down in the south of England, in Chichester, with Rufus and Claudia on it, which shows that that's where they got married. It says here that he was up in, what does it say here? In the Umbrian Apennines, but they found evidence of it in the south of England. Four children were the issue of this marriage: St. Timotheus, St. Novatus, St. Pudentiana, St. Praxedes. Two of the brothers of Claudia were St. Calinus, who ended his days in Britain, and Linus, who afterwards was ordained the first bishop of the Gentile Church at Rome by St. Paul, as St. Clement was of the Hebrew Church. So I guess what they're saying there was there a Hebrew Church at Rome as well? There was obviously this Gentile Church at Rome. And if you look at the names of the first bishops of Rome, Linus is the first one. And Linus was the son of Caradoc.
Yeah, what would their understanding have been of Gentile church back then at that time, do you think? Because
I think that's just R.W. Morgan using the term Gentile church.
Yeah, because obviously it's a common misconception nowadays, isn't it, with a Gentile being anyone that isn't of a particular race of Jews, so to speak. But that, I mean, that might be true from a Judeo perspective of the Bible, but it's not necessarily accurate, is it?
No, well, I think maybe he's putting that there because he's sort of implying that there was a Hebrew church of Rome, which I was unaware of. He's saying Linus was ordained first bishop of the Gentile church of Rome by St. Paul, as St. Clement was of the Hebrew church. So it seems to be saying that there was a Gentile church at Rome and a Hebrew church at Rome. So that's why R.W. Morgan is using those terms there. Rufus Pudens was converted to Christianity, probably by his wife, herself a convert of the Arimathean mission, certainly before the first arrival of St. Paul in Rome, for in his epistle to the Romans, written prior to such an arrival, Rufus is mentioned as already being, quote, chosen in the Lord. So this is the Rufus and Pudens that are mentioned in the book of Romans and also in the epistle to Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
So Rufus was one of the higher-ups in the Roman army, and Claudia was the daughter of Caradoc. And her name wasn't – Claudia was more of a nickname, basically, rather than her actual name. But we've got records of that with the Welsh records. In AD 56, St. Paul came to Rome. In AD 57, Bran, Caradoc, and the other members of the royal family of Silurea were converted and baptized by him. From this date, the Titulus became the home of St. Paul and of the other apostles whenever they visited Rome. The children of Claudia, who we mentioned above, were brought up literally upon their knees. Hermas, called Pastor from a work of his so entitled, was ordained the first minister to the Christians assembling for praise and prayer in this house. And you might have heard of it might be called the Shepherd of Hermas, which is a very old apocryphal book, which was written by this fellow, Hermas.
No, I've not heard of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of surrounding literature which talks about these people, basically. And they're tied in with Britain, which is something which isn't generally known, especially not the bits in Timothy.
What was that apocryphal book again?
Hermas. I think it's called The Shepherd of Hermas.
I'll have a look. I'll jot that down.
Yeah, the person that wrote it is called Pastor, and it's a very old apocryphal book. It didn't get included in the New Testament, but it talks about all of these people. And obviously, Paul and the apostles have got to have somewhere to stay when they are in Rome. And this really, you know, it knocks the stuffing out of this idea, oh, Christianity was a religion of slaves, which, you know, some pagans will come up with. Well, no, it was the British royal family that were some of the first Christians. And it was the palace, the British palace in Rome, that became the first church. So right. They may have been slaves, but there were also princes and kings that were involved.
It seems like, just opening up a PDF of it now, it seems like it's a series of visions, isn't it?
It could well be. I haven't looked at it for a long time. I couldn't tell you what the contents were, just that he's mentioned here. So there will be a connection somewhere in that book to this Titulus, the home of St. Paul,
okay,
in Rome. In AD 59... Aristobulus, the brother of St. Barnabas and the father-in-law of St. Peter, was ordained by St. Paul as the first bishop of the Britons, and he left Rome with Bran, Caradoc, and the royal family for Silurea. So they eventually left after their 7 years and went back to Caradoc's estates. Two other missionaries, Iltid and Cundav, quote, men of Israel, close quote, as they are termed in the Cymric genealogies of the primitive saints, accompanied him. So obviously they're not Jews, they're referring to them as men of Israel. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're written down as in the histories of the Celtic saints as being the first missionaries that came into Britain. They were known as men of Israel.
So right, that would have been interesting, isn't it?
Although, as we say, the Cimmerians and the Britons that were here were Israelites. They weren't Israelites that had stayed in Israel. They were Israelites that had left the main body of the people of Israel a thousand or so years before. But this Iltred and Kundav would have been men of Israel. They would have been Israelites that were actually in Judea at the time. So they would have been Hebrews, basically, but not Jews.
No, there's a lot of confusion about Jews. It's more or less a reference to a group of people and their religion now, isn't it?
Yeah. I was going to say it's more a religious thing, and it was back then. It was the Judean religion, and if you were a Jew, you were a Judean, which meant that you were a citizen of Judea. It didn't mean that you were descended from the Israelites. And they accepted what they called proselytes of the gate and proselytes of justice,
mm-hmm.
which could be anybody. Anybody could say they were going to follow the religion of Judaism and get themselves circumcised, and they were then called a Jew. And you had entire tribes of people that did that, particularly the Edomites. And I think we've mentioned it before, like King Herod was part Edomite, and he put Edomites in all the top positions in the priesthood. And that's why there was this animosity towards Christ from the Jews. It's referring to the Edomites, who, of course, are going to have animosity
towards. And there's scriptures in the New Testament which shows what Christ had to say about the proselytes. And it's not really something I've ever heard.
Not very flattering.
Come out. No, it's nothing kind of been recited by a modern day pastor or priest, let's say that.
Yeah, I can't remember the
he says to the Pharisees, obviously they're Edomites or something themselves, he says, oh, you travel land and sea to make one proselyte, and in doing so you make them twice the child of hell as yourself. And they're quite powerful words, isn't it?
Quite a condemnation of proselytizing into a religion that was supposed to be based on ethnicity. It was supposed to be based on heredity, as the Levites were, as the Druids were. They had to prove that they had been free man for 10 generations, and that was why they had that right. So to then go out and start making proselytes, that goes totally against, the whole... the whole point of the thing. If you're making promises to somebody's descendants, you can't induct somebody else into that promise, because it's not you making the promise, it's God that made the promise. So you can't say, well, you can just join us and then the promise applies to you as well. It wasn't them making the promise. So Bran himself is, on account of this, the second phase in the introduction of Christianity into Britain, known as one of the king benefactors of the island, and the epithet Benegedig or Henedictus or Blessed is generally attached to his name. So that's why Bran is called Bran the Blessed, because he came back from Rome with these two other missionaries, and that was the second wave of missionaries in Britain. And we're still only in AD 59. I think it was AD 34 when Joseph of Arimathea came over. Now we get to AD 59, and we get Aristobulus, who is Aristolihen, I think he's referred to as well. And he's the first one that really gets talked about in the Greek martyrologies and the Greek saint lists as the missionary that came to Britain is Aristobulus. And one of the very, very first missionaries to go anywhere was Aristobulus into Britain. And that was the second, as I say, it was the second wave of Christianity in Britain at the time. The following year, St. Paul himself is reputed to have visited his royal converts in Britain. And again, this is why we have St. Paul's in Britain. And there are places that are named after him. I don't know how true it is, but there's always been this belief or this legend that St. Paul himself came to Britain. And this would give a reason for him to come to Britain. R.W. Morgan certainly thinks that he did come to Britain. He says he returned after a stay of some months with Claudia, Pudens and Linus to the continent. In AD 67, after his second imprisonment at Rome, and on the evening preceding his execution, he wrote from the house of Claudius his farewell epistle to Timothy of Crete. The only salutations in it are to those of the family of the great British patriot, Pudens, Linus, Eubulus, and Claudia, who were thus, by the unsearchable ways of the Almighty, exalted through the fiery ordeal of national disasters and family humiliation to administer to the departing hours of the apostle and founder in Christ of the Gentile Church. No lovelier character than that of the high-born British matron, thus tending Paul the aged during the interval between the offering up of his body and his reception of the crown of glory prepared for him, is presented to our admiration in the pages of history, nor any instance more striking of the manner in which God, who bringeth good out of evil, overrules temporal calamities into agencies of eternal salvation. The introduction of the gospel into Britain from direct apostolic sources and under the highest secular auspices in the kingdom is traceable to a catastrophe which at the moment appeared not only irretrievable, but to militate against the justice of heaven in the government of nations. So it appeared to be a great catastrophe at the time that Caradoc had fallen and he'd been taken to Rome, and that was the great leader of the British armies. And it seemed to go against all justice, basically, for that to happen. But because that happened, St. Paul was there in the Palatium Britannicum, and they became Christian, and they brought the missionaries back to Britain, and Britain then became the first nation to become Christian about 100 years later. Because obviously it took time to build up the numbers of the Christians within the kingdom.
Yeah, time to spread as well.
Well, it might actually be worth leaving it here now, because the next section is on Boadicea, rather than beginning that today. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on any of this that you want to bring up here, Patriarch?
No, I'd like to understand a bit more about the early kind of transfer of religion, but I guess that's going to come out in another podcast, isn't it?
Well, it's a gradual process, isn't it? You know, it's not like a missionary turned up and the whole country decided to be Christian. You've got Joseph of Arimathea turns up and he's invited to by the Druids, and he and his people are given 12 hides of land. And then you've got Caradoc's family becomes a Christian, and when Caradoc is in Rome, she has St. Paul staying there, and St. Paul and Caradoc and his grandfather, Caradoc and his father Bran and his whole household then become Christian, and then his son is ordained to be the Bishop of Rome, Linus, by St. Paul, and then the family leave at the end of the 7 years to come back to Britain, and they bring back these missionaries with them. So originally you had Joseph of Arimathea with the Druids, and now you've got the missionaries with the royal family of Silurea, and then they spread out from there and over the next 100 years managed to convert enough of the country so that there was a unanimous vote in 150 AD. So it was a gradual process of winning people around to Christian living. And don't forget, we've also got Taliesin and the Bard saying that it wasn't anything new. It was new in the East, but there never was a time that the Druids of Britain didn't follow the Logos. They were following a form of Christianity before they were following Christianity. The same as the Hebrews and the Israelites were following a form of Christianity before actual Christianity. And it was the same with the Druids. So the British people just took to it, because it just seemed natural to them. And also, remember, the name of Jesus was the same. It was the same name that they had for their God anyway. And they understood sacrifice. They understood sacrifice for sin. They believed in the immortality of the human soul. There were so many similarities between what they believed and Christianity and also what the original Hebrews believed. So it was just a simple, gradual process, and the the archdruids became archbishops. So the same people that were high up in the druidic system were then high up in the Christian system as well. There was no animosity between them.
And yeah, yeah.
Living side by side. I mean, it's not like they became Christian and got rid of all their druidic understanding and druidic beliefs. The Christian beliefs evolved out of the druidic beliefs, and the two continued, you know, side by side. They didn't suddenly get rid of their druidic philosophy. They kept the druidic philosophy. I mean, that may even be where, you know, some of the influence on Christianity adopting the Trinity came from. May have originally been from the Druids, because they were very big into this Trinity. Their God was a triune God, past, present, and future.
I guess in some ways to appease the people and help them to convert more readily, they would it would just help, wouldn't it, with just integrating. It's like, okay, you can keep that, even if it's not, you know, strictly in line with what our culture.
Well, it did. We weren't idolaters. We wouldn't worship idols, and that's one of the reasons why we wouldn't go along with Rome and the worshiping of Caesar and the worshiping of idols. We didn't have any of that, and clearly we still kept our spiritual sites, because they then became Christian sites, and we still have the dolmens and the burial chambers and the stone circles and the standing stones and all of that. We still have all of them. We didn't destroy them all. And the holy wells got renamed, and the holy places that we already had, they built churches there. They started off with a little monk's structure with a hermit in it that would live the ascetic lifestyle. And then from that, they would grow like a farm, and then you would get monks there, or followers, disciples of this ascetic type of monk, and they would keep livestock and crops and grain, and they would help to feed the people. And people would bring them wealth and leave them wealth, because they knew that these monks wouldn't spend it, and they'd use it to acquire more land and grow more crops and more food, and they'd feed the peasantry with it. We didn't have a benefit system. And we didn't have like organized charities. The church was responsible for all of this, and at the same time was educating people. You know, if it wasn't for the church, we wouldn't have any schooling. This idea that religion is anti-knowledge or anti-science is completely false, because the Christian religion is all about observing the natural world and coming to the truth from observing the natural world. That's the whole point of it. The more you study, the more you learn, the more you... the more you are convinced of the veracity of Christianity. And that was the whole general gist of Christianity, and why they wanted people to learn how to read, why we had Sunday school, why you educated people. It wasn't because, we're trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes here. I think so many people that are anti-Christian, if they only actually knew the real history of it, you'd see that it's totally different to these pagan ideas that people have today, which are all entirely modern, have all come about in the last century. Because these things that we're talking about here, I mean, this is ancient history. This is before the Saxons came. This is before the Christianity of Augustine. This is before Pauline Christianity, really, because Joseph of Arimathea was here teaching Christianity before St. Paul had even converted.
Yeah.
That's why the church was so different to the one that St. Augustine was used to when he came over from Rome. And yet they admit, and Bede admits, that we had bishops here, we had churches here, and it was fully established. And Alfred the Great had to come to the Welsh church to find men of sufficient learning to teach his Saxons how to read and write in the 9th century.
Hmm.
So we weren't savages. The Romans might have called us barbarians, but we were their equals.
I think it's more of a prestige thing, isn't it? You know, they call anyone who's not in the in club a barbarian, and I guess if you didn't speak a certain language, you were barbaric.
Yeah, so we had an alphabet.
Kind of just, yeah.
Anyway, we had the same ancestry as them. This illustrious ancestry that Julius Caesar had. Well, Caradoc had the same ancestry. Brutus had the same ancestry. We had an alphabet. We were on an even footing with the Greeks and the Romans. Yet you wouldn't think that today, because they cover it all up. Anyway,
yeah,
I think we'll leave that there. Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for another good podcast.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.